I do need control of the clicker. Yes, thank you. And just to say that I don't know whether this is to honour you or whether I'm frightened of you, but there are 14 pages of notes that I've got for you today. Now, the good news is that because I've not got my glasses on, it's in a very large font. So, but the other, perhaps it's good news, copies of my notes are available at coffee time. And coffee time will be at 10 past 11. So there, all the good news at once. And you need some good news because I fear that I am going to at least spend 10 minutes of this morning depressing you. Because I'm going to make a case that we are living in troubled times. And beyond troubled times is a thing called dystopia. Now, if you're a gamer, and I mean playing computer games, then you know what dystopia is. Because most of the games that people play are about the world gone wrong and how the person who's busy twiddling thumbs is the hero who is going to make the world right again. But looking round, it doesn't seem to me as if you have particularly agile thumbs, so I will explain what I mean by dystopia. A dystopian perspective certainly expects that the future will be worse than the past. That, in living memory and in our assumptions, is a very unusual state of affairs, that the future will be worse than the past and the present. And it applies to all aspects of life. And it might begin with something quite small and modest, but that anxiety gets bigger and bigger and more dreadful. And each concern branches out into a host of other concerns. I illustrate it with horse chestnuts, where I walk the dog most mornings on Streatham Common. And those horse chestnuts are affected by two diseases, and of course possibly associated with the pollution in the area. And then, of course, I think, oh, health and safety. These ancient, must be two-year-old horse chestnuts. Soon, the local authority will have to come to a decision which says, those horse chestnuts are now a threat to safety. And we can't afford to just choose and monitor each one. We'll just take them all out. And then you think, if that's happening here, where else is this happening? That's the kind of dystopian dynamic, that one worrisome thing moves to a host of other worrisome things. And of course, when we watch the news, listen to the news, the chances are that each item adds for a dismal assemblage of thoughts, which often emphasize our lack of capacity to put things right. You could certainly monitor it with the autumn statement. Upbeat? No. And of course, one of the issues that we face is that now experts, who are the experts? But often the experts in their opinions are more dismal than ordinary kind of thought. And what we've learnt is that globalisation, the ability for us now to traverse the globe, whether it be as holiday makers or as people seeking work or as people seeking a more viable life, that has come to represent an increased level of anxiety. And of course, what it also calls for is that we have to learn to live with those who are not like ourselves, people who are different from us. And I think for us as Christians, as people of faith, we've now come to be viewed as a kind of remedial class, that we are the people who are slow developers, slow to get rid of this very disturbing dynamic called religion. That religious people, whereas we are of the habit of presuming that we are on the side of the angels, but for those of us who take our faith seriously, whether Christian or Islamic, we are seen as being actually a threat to the well-being of our creation. So I want to bring to you Zygmunt Bauman. Now, don't be put off by Zygmunt Bauman, because he might be one of your neighbours. He's a Polish lad from Leeds. And he, very early on, spotted the anxiety that would be provoked by globalisation. Before I go any further, could you just admire the chair? Now, my forensic mind suggests, looking at that chair, that I might not be alone at falling asleep when I try to read a book. Can you see the telltale sign? Does anybody have him as their neighbour, Zygmunt Bauman? He must live in this part of Yorkshire. He's an emeritus professor of sociology at the University of Leeds. Came to Leeds in 1974, so the bulk of his life would have been spent here. And probably a modern-day prophet. He says very early on that globalisation, rather than bringing a greater toleration of diversity, it's likely to turn us into tribes. He calls it neo-tribalism, that we actually associate more and more with those who are like us in response to that anxiety provoked by those who are different moving into our space. And he says that we will be having a stronger sense of identification, and you might track this in our church life. Certainly, the political arena would seem to suggest that views are being held with more rigour, maybe even more extremism. He's saying this Polish chap who lives in Leeds, he was saying it in 1998. But what he then goes on to say is that underneath this is the dynamic of scapegoating, the pointing the finger, looking for somebody to blame. And in fact, in our culture, it would seem that once we've found somebody who has caused it, it almost gains the stature of a scientific explanation. When we are anxious, we are inclined to look for somebody or some group to blame for our misery. And so what I'm wanting to emphasise is that as Christians, there is a greater need for us to be alert to those dynamics that we experience within ourselves. So the dynamic of blaming, urging, wanting to say, why am I feeling this discomfort, this feeling that the world's getting more troubled, that all of us will have that anxiety which wants to point to those whom we can blame. And that, I think, brings a new feature, a greater profile to a particular aspect of our discipleship. We need to be alert to our reaction of trying to find comfort in tribalism, that intensification of a sense of us. And then the second feature of that is this getting caught up in the perception of them carrying a threat to us. Classic story throughout history. So our challenge to our discipleship is to eschew, I love that word, eschew disciple, scapegoating. Scapegoating is really about death dealing. And of course, as we look at the Hebrew scriptures, it is a story of the scapegoat. The reason why we as Christians need to be very attentive and eschew, avoid, get rid of, monitor, check, be alert to this urge to scapegoat, to blame, to see them, is because Jesus quite unambiguously insists that he is the end of scapegoating. And it's a feature of what Jesus brings that I think we haven't really put under the spotlight sufficiently. So I'm going to bring you another young chap. This time he has a more elegant chair because he's French. René Girard. And of course, for those of you who've been sitting reading and not falling asleep in the armchair, you will know as soon as we say scapegoating, the name of René Girard emerges. I'm very fond of René Girard because it appeals to my Bootle Bible Belt upbringing. Because Girard is an anthropologist, but an anthropologist who does his work by looking at literature and exploring how literature gives insights into the deep dynamics of a culture. He, in particular, was interested in scapegoating. And he starts to say, well, why? What's the basis of it? And he makes a suggestion which he gives a rather posh term to. He refers to it as the mimetic of desire. We might call it keeping up with the Joneses. Because what he says, that the urge to scapegoat is basically rooted in a kind of jealousy. But it's jealousy with a twist. Because we learn what is desirable by observing what others find desirable. So there's no original thinking in this. It is that we are copycats. I saw somebody in shoes like these and I thought, oh, I'd like them. I want them. Scapegoating results in the repeated disappointment of wanting something and not being able to get it. This is, you know, very kind of earthed, common sense view that Girard promotes. So we catch our desires from what others have found desirable. And of course, we then seek to obtain it in an economy of scarcity. And I'm going to use later on this term, economy of scarcity, in order to contrast it with an economy of abundance. And I'll say this now and I'll repeat it later, that just as the economy of scarcity is very real, so too is the economy of abundance. But that we have less confidence in it and less honed imagination to be able to negotiate this economy of abundance. But let's stay with the situation when our focus is limited to an economy of scarcity. Girard suggests, and he's making an anthropological point rather than a kind of ethical point, he says, do you know what? Scapegoating is terribly efficient. It's effective. Because there's a kind of shoddy solidarity that comes from hating the other. That there's a kind of scorched earth type urge which gives a kind of perverse satisfaction. Scapegoating, having somebody to blame, seems to make us feel better, but at immense cost. Why Girard is so interesting is that as an anthropologist, he starts to look at the Hebrew Bible and the Good News, which is represented in our Gospels. And in these Judeo-Christian texts, he traces a movement away from the dynamic of scapegoating through the Old and into the New Testaments. And it's this movement which turns Girard into a Christian. It takes his breath away that in such a distant culture there should be an explicit naming of the dynamic of scapegoating. But then he reads the good news and he starts to see insights which, as far as he's concerned, exists nowhere else in the literature that the species has created. Because when he reads the Bible, new and old, as literature, he reads that this is the character of Jesus who says, "I am the final scapegoat." And as he reads the New Testament stories, this is the first literature that has ever been written that's on the side of the scapegoat. This is the first literature that has been created by the species which says, see the world through the eyes of the scapegoat, the one who is going to take the blame. And then the literature, and he's not interested in the reality of it all, but he says, this is literature which says, do you know what? You kill the scapegoat. And the scapegoat returns. That symbolism of the uselessness of the dynamic of scapegoating. Because the scapegoat will return. Once you blame them and you get rid of them, there will be somebody else, another group, whom we seek to blame. The scapegoat will always return. But in the Gospels, what we get is that the scapegoat returns triumphant. And then he says, when you see the journey that this literature makes through human history, and the literature itself, it says there is an action that people are invited to engage in, which acts out the seizing of the scapegoat and the scapegoat's triumph over death. And we call it the Eucharist. So one of the things I invite you to do, that each time we partake of the Lord's Supper or whatever description we want to give to it, that walk is a walk that is about eschewing the urge to scapegoat, which all of us in our daily lives will find ourselves drifting towards. We will all have that element within us. So what Girard says is that our Bible and the associated enacted process, the Eucharist, exposes a fundamental response to what would otherwise be an irresistible move to violence. I've just got a quote here, and I'm not quite sure why I've got it, other than I like it. Harold Evans, another old chap. I haven't got a picture of him sitting in his armchair. But he talks, I think it was in response to Donald Trump's election, because, of course, Harold Evans used to run, he was editor of one of the broadsheets, and I think has a role in the United States. And he says, there seems to be an ache at the heart of so many countries. And I thought that was a compassionate description of what is rather, I think, unfairly referred to as the rise of populism. Because we know what an aching heart feels like, and we know some of the steps we can take to ease that ache. So although it's a rather sad description, maybe, of our troubled times, at least it gives a platform from which we are not helpless. We just have aching hearts. And that means, the reason why I think I like that term, is that it gives us the invitation to reflect on these troubled times. And I want to use the word reflective as opposed to being reactive. The difference is a bit like Granny saying count 10. When we are reflective, we are allowing all aspects of our brain to flow into action. When we're being reactive, the chances are we are in our reptile brain. And let me say, I am not kidding when I say the word reptile brain. It genuinely is referred to as the reptile brain, because it gains that title because, like a reptile, when we are in that particular part of our brain, the most primitive form of our brain, we are like a reptile with a speed of response and a cold-blooded nature. It's Peter Stanky makes the description. He says, the survival brain's strength is quickness. It's the reptile brain. But its speed is at the expense of the thinking brain's accuracy. During anxious times, instinct overpowers intention, and impulse eliminates reflection. In troubled times, people react rather than respond. And it's his terms. We pull the trigger of survival in reacting quickly and thoughtlessly. So when we're anxious and we're aggrieved, we look for alliances. Because what we want to do, that's the temptation. The temptation is to share and energize the grievance. And before long, hatred can result. Now, the reason why I'm kind of lingering on this is because when we talk about anxiety, anxiety is not the last word. We can do things about anxiety. And I want to kind of share with you some spiritual habits that we can cultivate, because we, like everybody else, will be affected by anxiety as we negotiate troubled times, as we acknowledge the ache at the heart of many countries. So I want to just linger on the idea of anxiety reduction. And of course, the people who are so good at this are the Mennonites. Because when they look at the life of Jesus, what they see is so significant is that Jesus was a man who was a man of peace and a man who wanted and longed for peace. And so they have studied how you are a disciple working for peace. And what they have unfurled is the recognition that so often we breach the peace because we are anxious, we are troubled. Now, what I'm saying is not about anxiety as a struggle with mental well-being. I'm talking about almost the habitual anxiety that we are all prone to, particularly as we worry what is to become of our world. So the art of anxiety reduction. Oops, you're not supposed to be there. There we go. Oh, I've given my best line away. First of all, is to be aware of your reactive buttons. Metaphorical buttons that people can press inadvertently, and it puts us on edge. And they'll often have their root in our family or community of origin. So although I'm trying my best not to sound like a bootle book, if I hear a posh accent, I'm immediately on edge. It's my problem. And it comes in part from the community of origin. And no matter how hard I work, my first reaction to somebody who speaks proper is not a good one. Now, I humiliate myself with that illustration of my reactive button, because most of our reactive buttons are pretty humiliating. But it is an invitation for you to own your own, because they will be so distinctive. but it is as well as we negotiate troubled times to know what it is that's more likely to put us on edge than not. That we need to discipline both our heads and our hearts, that all problems, all issues have multiple and interrelated causes. They say if you ask the question why 5 times, at some point you and I will be implicated in the why. So there isn't any innocence in this, and of course you can see that we're now just on the cusp of realizing just how significant a liberated view of sin can be. That all of us contribute, both in perceptible and imperceptible ways, to the distress of the world. And of course, that awareness is not a complex one. You will have detected already that my first port of call is as a social scientist. But it amazes me that the social sciences have no category equivalent to sin. And of course, if our world was able to own the reality that we all contribute mysteriously and directly to the grief, to the ache that is at the heart of both individuals and nations, then our politics would take a different shape. And of course, we would also know our need for a saviour and that great Advent call. So a systems approach is essential if we are to prevent ourselves falling prey to it's Tessie's fault. And that systems thinking is both, it sounds complex and yet it is so intuitively right. And of course the thing about a systems approach is the change in one area, good change or bad change, reverberates throughout the system, which is wonderfully effective. You know, it means that little things, the flap of the butterfly's wings, has a repercussion somewhere else in the system. And so I'm going to talk a little bit later about the significance of micro actions. A determination to resist picking up other people's anxieties. That's not about saying don't bother with pastoral care and listening to people well, but it is about resisting adding to people's problems, because the urge when we feel discomfort is to try and get others to join me in that discomfort, herding. That we need to cultivate the skill of being a step-down transformer, the discipline of reducing the voltage, the power of the emotion that's running in a system. We need to be able to contain our own anxiety. And then develop the ability to be a non-anxious self, a non-anxious presence. And that's not about saying there's no anxiety. It's about being able to park that anxiety. In other words, to consciously get out of that reptile brain, which we might be in so habitually that we're not even aware that we are having to cope with anxiety physically and emotionally. The way in which we park our reptile brain, one might be singing, by the way, one might be fun and laughter. Lovely kingdom reversal. It's very hard to have fun and play. Question mark around laughter, because laughter can actually be part of that journey of making other, the mocking of people and groups of people. She says this as a very sensitive Scouser. But perhaps one of the most helpful ways for us, because prayer matters to us, is to learn from the Buddhists. Because the Buddhists, in settling for meditation, as they settle their physical entity, they will soften their eyes. Now, I'm softening my eyes, and you might detect that my voice changes, because you can't kind of declaim with soft eyes. And kids know about what the eyes do when the eyes go hard. Stop eyeballing me. Get out of me face. All those expressions are a clue that the eyes are saying more than we think. Now, it's such a vague thing, you know, and possibly you're all sitting there trying to soften your eyes. And that's why I was a bit upset that this one turned up early. Because one of the sure ways of softening our eyes is to look on the face of a baby. You know, the fact that we can go coo, 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 what's going on there? We change. Now, I'm sure at a theological society, I don't have to join up the dots about God made manifest in the form of a baby. Just, it's a bit like on par with Girard's discovery that the Bible, the story of God's involvement with his creation, is one which takes us beyond scapegoating. God's involvement with his creation takes us beyond the anxiety which seems to be a characteristic of our species. I've just got one little quote that I'd like to leave with you. It's not on there. It will be on the sheets. It's about Dante in the Divine Comedy. When he finally arrives in paradise, and he's been through all the trials and tribulations that are expressed in the Divine Comedy, he hears the laughter of angels praising the Trinity. According to Dante, in hell there is neither hope nor laughter. In purgatory there is hope but no laughter. But in heaven there is no need for hope. So laughter reigns. That laughter is hope's last word. Tim mentioned that this organization is the theology and mission. Mission is its focus. The beginning of mission is to be a group of people who laugh easily and well. That fun and playfulness, in a time of anxiety, whether it's anxiety about the future of our church or anxiety about the future of, in inverted commas, civilization, that playfulness and laughter are really subversive activities. Because as Christians, we cannot give up on hope. But you would expect me to say this, coming from a social responsibility stable, that the good news is not just a communication, it also makes things happen. So in our dystopian troubled times, hope, if it's to be effective, if it's to be real, has to be performed, not just spoken. And it's a kind of chastising, really, for much of the way in which we do hope in our church, because we tend to do hope with reference to verses from the Bible. But of course, that approach to hope, that, you know, I can see hope here because it's in Paul's letter to the Thessalonians, that kind of approach cannot cut across the ever-thickening membrane of believer and non-believer. That our use of the Bible, although I've kind of praised it in a way as being unique as literature, it doesn't travel, because no longer can one person tell another what to believe. So hope cannot come from the reciting of Bible passages. That might be all right for us, maybe it creates an even thicker membrane between us and those who are not us. So we have to develop ways of enacting hope in the midst of dismay. So it's hope that's accompanied by action. I am not going to now depart into various social action ventures and articulate how they speak of hope. And that's what I was going to do. But it feels as if there's something rather banal about that. There's something, you know, it's all right if you live in, I don't know, but it doesn't work if you're in Harrogate. You know, where do you do the work of enacting hope? You know, there'd be a great rush to look after home, the six homeless people. I remember doing a presentation in Pinner, and the people of Pinner said, oh, it'd be great, we could do that if we had homeless people. So, how do we do enacted hope? It involves micro actions, tiny, tiny, tiny little actions, which at first insight might seem insignificant. And I want to illustrate enacted hope through little micro moments by exploring the conversation that Jesus has with the woman at the well. I can't see what this is. Yeah, I can see that picture. Right, I'm up to date. This is the longest recorded conversation that Jesus has with anybody. John 4, it takes from verse 7 to verse 26. And it provides an excellent example of how conversation can enact hope. Because a conversation is a series of micro actions. And conversation is an extraordinary way in which the transgressive, that doesn't mean sinful, but the crossing of boundaries, energy of the Holy Spirit can work, can actually extend the bonds of love beyond cultures and communities. So with this story, what we have is that Jesus is tired and hot and thirsty and without any access to water, although he's sitting next to a well. And he asks for water from a Samaritan woman. First micro action, a conversation where the supposedly powerful speaks from a position of vulnerability. And it's also, there's a second micro-action, because what Jesus is doing is he's stepping outside the formal restrictions of tribalism of that period. And then there is friendly banter. The banter is about water that never runs out. And of course, for the woman who's there, she says, oh gosh, that had saved me an awful lot of hard work, drawing water from this really deep well. Banter. It's a little micro action, because what banter is about is a mutual commitment to sustain the encounter. It's a mutual commitment to sustain the encounter. And then Jesus says to her, oh, go and call your husband and come back. That's the fourth micro action that I detect. Because what Jesus is doing there is he's being sensitive to the impossibility of continuing to sustain that conversation with the woman while she is alone. Because custom made a sustained conversation by a woman and a male stranger hugely inappropriate and, of course, would bring damage to that woman's reputation. So the woman at that point is confronted by quite a, well, am I going to disclose how I am, who I am? And of course she does, and this is the fifth micro action, risk taking, because the woman feels confident enough to make a disclosure. And then suddenly Jesus understands her situation. Because he knows how the culture would work, that she must have been passed from pillar to post, Five men have married her and divorced her, and the bloke who's taken her in this time isn't prepared to give her the status of wife. And more than this, Jesus can now work out why it is she comes to draw water in the heat of the day. Because he can now understand that she probably feels so excluded and disparaged by her neighbours that she finds it preferable to draw her water in the midday heat. Because then she can be assured that she's not going to have to meet and rub shoulders with anybody. So the sixth micro-action, a compassionate aha, a sudden insight into how it is for the other person. And of course then in this conversation, the woman recognises the potency of Jesus and she tries to change the direction of the conversation. And we all know it. She starts to say, oh, we Samaritans, we worship on this mountain here. You do it in the temple in Jerusalem. You know, we're not the same. The seventh micro-action, a retreat back into tribalism. And then Jesus says, no, do you know there's a God of truth whom everyone can worship in spirit? The eighth micro-action, the offer of a new inclusive paradigm. And the woman stays with him and she says, do you know, I've heard something of this, that there's actually a Messiah who will bring us together and explain these things to us. I reckon that's the ninth micro-action in this conversation, because at this point, personal knowledge and experience are coming together, coalescing. And Jesus declares, I who speak to you am he. And we read that the conversation continues until the disciples return. And then at this point, the actions cease to be micro, because the woman dashes back to the village to encourage others to come to the well, where she has met up with a chap who could be Christ. It seems to me that that conversation was as significant for Jesus as it was for the woman. The people of the village asked Jesus to stay with them, and he stayed with them for 2 days. Unlike the reading that we had earlier on, the people of the Gadarenes, who out of fear, even though Jesus had been offering liberation, the response was one of fear. Go away. And it may well be that as a species, we have to do battle with fear before we can actually meet the living Lord. So conversation, and that can be part of the Harrogate story, is an essential aspect of transformation. Because often, until we hear ourselves think, we don't really know what we think. Because it's through conversation that we turn around our ideas and our experiences with each other. And that story of the woman at the well highlights the potency of conversation, especially when that conversation is between those who've been shaped and formed by other cultures and contexts. In risking conversation, especially with those whose perspective and life experiences are different from our own, we are trusting that patience and generosity of spirit will be found in the other, as we distill in their presence what we are coming to know. Just to mention the extraordinary thing about the woman, who Paulo Freire would have described as mute, not able really to claim a space to be heard, because of self-esteem being so damaged, perhaps. This conversation, the woman finds her voice. and a voice which is about inviting others to partake of something which is profoundly generous. Now, I want to just do a little aside and look at early Methodism, because I want to say that early Methodism was an extraordinary achievement of the species. Because what was going on in the Methodist class was conversation. But it was conversation that was rooted in vulnerability and wretchedness, rather than competence and knowing the answer and expertise. And of course, one of the things that has happened in much of our church life is that when we come together, we come often with our sorted selves and not that self whose heart aches. Early Methodism, because there was no shame, because wretchedness was so extensive, enabled people to speak from the place of vulnerability. So just take a close look at this one, by the way. There's a chap who's beating a drum, a couple of them beating drums, somebody's blowing a horn, in order that what is being said cannot be heard. That's kind of an English experience of oppression of people of faith. But it's worth noting that, because what we get with the Methodist class, and don't forget, this is prior to having church buildings, and I've admired this building wondrously, but I don't know whether it's a building for the class as in early Methodism. Because what it enabled was people to have the opportunity to hear themselves think. It was a process that supported intentionality, a rising above circumstances. That's why the model of class, the Methodist class, is so significant in relation to Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. And it created a generous solidarity. I'll work for you as you struggle to get bits of your life back on track. It was a movement that didn't kill anybody despite maltreatment. It had a belief in people being transformed. I suspect, although I couldn't defend it, I think it was one of the first organisations which introduced accountable leadership, which is maybe why Methodism trips over itself at the moment with all its committees and structures. And it also demonstrated a confidence in abundance, which meant that they could risk far-reaching and sustained generosity. And I think, and I've added another because I was reading on the train, that along with nonconformists, Methodists were pioneers of politics as a vocation. An extraordinary achievement. I share this because, not to blame that we're not there now, because it was such an exceptional achievement, we were destined to fall back from it. No shame. But it does give us some clues about what we can seek to achieve in the future. So I want just to say a little bit now about abundance, as well as an economy of scarcity, and then to conclude with what a resilient theology would look like. Our whole evolutionary journey has been characterized by a battle against shortage. And of course, that's resulted in an assumption that the good things in life are all in short supply, and that an appropriate purpose in life is to try and get those good things for ourselves. That kind of view of shortage, and so much of our politics is around the assumption of shortage, that it is, in a sense, damaged, denuded our imagination about the economy of abundance. And of course, Jesus, in inviting us to invest in the self-denying generosity that's at the heart of the way in which he lived his life, is making not so much an intellectual or moral challenge, but a challenge to our imagination. graced actions need us to be reflective rather than reactive. A graced action, and you could use the illustration of that conversation with the woman at the well, as like a portal, a door into a generous, generative economy of abundance. That when we have had an open and warm conversation, perhaps with an unexpected moment, people are changed, and the chances are they'll go on to cascade that virtue. So one of the difficulties we have is that we are confident in dystopian times of one bad thing leading to a host of other bad things. As Christians, we have to keep alive that dangerous awareness that just as there are vicious cycles, so too there are virtuous ones, where one good thing can lead to a host of other good things. Before we have coffee, I want to summarise on the challenge to our discipleship. Our discipleship in troubled times means that we have to struggle, I think, with some particular disciplines, which weren't the disciplines of the time when I was born, that period when you have never had it so good, said Mr. Macmillan. That I have to learn to be a non-anxious presence in stressful times when the heart of nations ache. I have to practice systemic thinking in order to resist the temptation to blame others when things go wrong. I have to engage in courageous micro-actions that counter the inclination towards neo-tribalism and fragmentation. I need to gain confidence in the viability of an economy of abundance and trust that generosity into which Jesus inducts us, rather than to be beholden to the economy of scarcity. And as I've done with that little brief excursion into early Methodism, to draw on the enriching memories of eras past in order to affirm the human capacity to correct our own errors, or in more theological language, to turn about. In order to achieve those challenges as of discipleship, I think we need to think more about the process of church that is needed. That we need to church, and please let us turn church from a noun to a verb, to church, in order to embrace reflective rather than reactive behaviour, to help us hold off that urge for neo-tribalism, for resentment, bloodlust, hatred, and to help us incorporate the practice of Jesus. Because what we see in Jesus is a very distinctive performance. Performance is not something that's false in this context, not an act that's put on, but it's a way of being for which we have rehearsed through our prayerfulness and given deep reflection to. It is a studied way of behaving. And of course, what we get in that distinctive performance of Jesus is to make a reality of the economy of abundance and not limit our imagination to the economy of shortage. And that brings me to a very important emphasis, that Jesus saves us not just through death and resurrection. That's what I was taught and emphasized throughout my journey as from a smaller Christian to a larger, fatter Christian. is that Jesus saves us by showing us how to live. And that is what will travel in troubled times. The idea that Jesus shows us how to live can travel through that thickening membrane between secular and faithful living. I want to move on with that in mind to finish with the theology that has to change for our troubled times. We need a theology that is resilient enough to resonate with really our growing sense of vulnerability, that we are like the sorcerer's apprentice who has claimed powers that are actually at risk of getting beyond us. So vulnerability is our natural state, that we are generations which have forgotten that we've got a bit uppity, and that vulnerability can be a thin place, to use the term that George MacLeod from Iona coins, because when we are vulnerable, we are more open to God. We increase the likelihood of meeting God because we need God. But the theology that is resilient for troubled times will also always embrace gratitude. Because in troubled times, gratitude and thanksgiving are glorious acts of defiance. A resilient theology insists that dismay and passivity are not the final words. We're not just sitting, waiting, I was going to say, for the final trump. Isn't that ironic? A resilient theology enables us not just to see new possibilities, but to garner the intentionality, the determination, the solidarity, to be able to practice these possibilities. And this is my final point on why I think we might rejoice in the splendour of what we can create as church. But we also have to be very aware that it's not the way forward. Because we have to always acknowledge human frailty to the extent that perfection can never be expected. Because otherwise, the liberating generosity of being treated better than we deserve becomes null and void. The real alternative performance of Jesus was to say that you need a saviour. And in troubled times, there is this extraordinary possibility that we've moved closer than ever of our times of competence and affluence and security to know our need for a saviour. And that, I think, is a really good Advent message. Thank you very much.